Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, arbitration, collective bargaining, and the Supreme Court. And Richard, we had a decision from the Supreme Court last week in a case called Epic Systems v. Lewis over the enforceability of arbitration clauses for contracts for non-union workers. Now, this is a significant case, but from that description, people who are not labor law specialists like yourself might already be having their eyes glaze over. So before we even get to the law and the legal questions, why don't we start with the basics? Tell us about how arbitration functions and what the arguments from its boosters and its detractors look like. Why is this valuable to some people? Why is it opposed by others?
Well, the simplest explanation as to why arbitration is valuable is it's a boom business in virtually every area of life. When I started teaching 50 years ago, there was a fair bit of arbitration. But at the present point in time, virtually all major commercial disputes are dissolved by arbitrators. All sorts of other cases go through that. The arbitrations are not only domestic, they're also international. The level of compliance with judgments, no questions asked after arbitration, is over 99% in major cases. So why do people gravitate to this and how do they make it work? Well, the first thing what they do is they set their own set of ground rules. And the ground rules tend to be much more informal than the formal rules of evidence on what can be said and who can say it. Then what they do is they pick an arbitrator, usually one in big arbitrations, three in consumer arbitrations, a kind of anomaly. And the arbitrators are often former federal judges or state court judges who know how to handle these cases. And what happens is you say, well, we're going to arbitrate. We're going to do it on Tuesday at 9 a.m. And you don't have to put yourself on the back of a calendar so that you're not in a situation where you have to wait years before you get a debate. You don't have to go through all the battles before judges in the pretrial phase of situations through depositions and discovery because you can handle that yourself. So essentially, it's a self-created scheme. And it turns out that it's cheaper, it's more reliable, it gets done more quickly, and it has the following additional public benefit, apart from making these contracts work well, is it just removes a clutter that would otherwise take place in state or federal courts. So I think you could probably say that for commercial transactions today, broadly conceived, including employment contracts, for example, with respect to senior officers and so forth, arbitration has become a dominant system. And in this particular situation, employers in non-union shops essentially want to have arbitration of particular grievances. It's also worth noting that in most union contracts, there are arbitration clauses which stipulate that the union shall represent the worker if it thinks fit, and the employer shall have a representative, and they'll solve it in the same efficient way. So if unions themselves want to have arbitration agreements with employers, they're saving their cost. In non-union shops, these things are quote-unquote imposed. Take it or leave it. But every contract term sooner or later is take it or leave it, because if I always have to yield to you on something where you disagree and you always have to yield to me, there'll never be an agreement one way or another. These things have been used for a very long period of time in a large number of contexts. And in fact, employers swear by them at this particular point in time. And many workers like them as well, because the lower cost is something from which they benefit. And if they think that the deck is not stacked against them, they would rather have a quick and cheap resolution of these disputes. Knowing that these things are going to be resolved quickly means that you probably resolve most of the stuff through informal negotiations in the shadow of the arbitral process. And so it's not as though anybody has been able to point out in these cases some systematic defect which requires massive federal intervention or legal oversight.
All right, so let's get to the actual law here. This case turned to some degree on what rights workers have to band together in an adversarial action against an employer and under what circumstances. So tell us how the lower courts, really in this case the Seventh Circuit, had answered that question and how the Supreme Court replied.
Well, the lower court opinion is a very careful, very meticulous opinion by Diane Wood, who's the chief judge on the Seventh Circuit. I thought she was wrong. And what you have to do is you have to reconcile two statutes. And the arbitral statute is one which essentially says that when you're dealing with these contracts, they should be valid, irrevocable, and enforceable, right? that's kind of tough language. Save upon grounds as existed at law or in equity for the revocation of any contract. And the words law and equity for most people are a real stumper. And what this means in standard American and English practice back in 1925, a court of law would give damage remedies or set aside a contract for, say, for fraud. A court in equity would not give damages but specific performance and would set aside a contract for undue influence. And they wanted to make sure that all the grounds by which you could set aside or revoke a contract, any contract, would apply there. So they're not talking about particular cases. And then on the other side, when you get to the National Labor Relations Act, what it says is not only do people have the right to join unions through elections and so forth, but they can engage in other concerted activities, that is getting together one with another, for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid and protection. And so the question then is, what's the way in which these two clauses interact? And Diane's opinion, which was followed in much more vitriolic and less thoughtful terms by Justice Ginsburg, is that the second statute takes over the first. And the reason why it turns out that this happens is that the notion of a collective action allows people to join together in litigation. And that's exactly what these workers are doing when they're bringing class action suits to challenge various classification decisions under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And she says that you can set them aside because of illegality. And that's her first mistake. Generally speaking, when you're talking about illegality, it doesn't have anything to do with the formation of this particular contract. That would be a situation in which you beat somebody up or lie to them about its formation and so forth. Illegality says that you cannot enforce a particular contract because it's against public policy. And so the position that the majority took and Justice Thomas took in a short concurrence was you have to show why this particular contract fails in its formation stage. The fact that it is or is not enforceable in particular cases is something for the arbitrator to decide. And if that's the correct view, then you never get to the conflict between the two statutes because it turns out that illegality is not the kind of defense that is worried about in this particular case. The second point is, how do you treat collective action? And it's very clear that in certain cases, when there's a non-union shop, workers get together in order to try to persuade other union workers to join a union. And there's no question that this is legal in all businesses, whether or not a union is in fact on the books. In some cases, they even go to court. So one of the cases that is cited below is a case involving the NFL. And this is a very bizarre situation because it's a strongly unionized situation. They reach an impasse. And what happens is instead of putting it to compulsory arbitration, because those guys do not want that, the union dissolves. And it says, we're no longer a union. Now, why would they dissolve? Because they said, now once we dissolve, we can sue you for the collective refusal to deal as a bunch of teams under the antitrust law. And that threat of lawsuit then brings the two parties to the table. They make an agreement, and magically the union reforms. My own view is you should never allow those sham dissolutions. But that is not what the law is today. But that's obviously the kind of collective action here. So what's going on in this particular case is, are the two statutes in conflict? I think the answer is no. And then, as Justice Gorsuch pointed out in his opinion, sometimes if the two statutes are in conflict, it's not that the later statute governs the earlier statute. Often the better rule is a much more specific statute talking about a particular problem governs a general statute where the implications are more difficult to make. And it's very clear through the entire legislative history, not a word was said about arbitration agreements of individual grievances. It was also the case until 2012 in the Obama administration that everybody who looked at this thing thought that the two statutes worked on separate tracks. And so the question is whether or not you now defer to the Obama administration's reinterpretation of this. I thought Gorsuch was correct when he says, I don't like the deference generally, but I'm certainly not going to defer to what a partisan National Labor Relations Board says about another statute, the Federal Arbitration Act, over which it doesn't have a jurisdiction. So, I mean, these are pretty technical arguments, but the upshot of it is, If you're dealing with individual grievances, a firm can deal with them. If you're dealing with class actions, it's not that you have an equality of bargaining power. You give the union a huge club. And the basic rule in all class action litigation is if the class is certified, and in cases like this, it's likely, an employer has to settle. So the definition that Ms. Justice Ginsburg has of equality of bargaining power is you've got a small firm with 1,000 employees and you have a huge international union coming after them with skilled class action lawyers. What are these people supposed to do? You may want to call that equality of bargaining power. I call it heavy coercion.
In her dissent here, Justice Ginsburg invoked a boogeyman from the past, the yellow dog contract, which she regarded as a horror that oppressed the working man. Richard, I happen to know that you hold no such animus towards the yellow dog contract. Explain for our listeners what it was and what the Ginsburg argument, which is by no means exclusive to her, gets wrong.
Well, I mean, the yellow dog contract was thought by progressives in the period between, say, 1910 and 1935, when they were enforceable, to be the ultimate sin, because what they said is that if you wish to work for me in my particular firm, what you have to do is to agree not to join a union while you're working for me and have to agree not to promise a union that you will join them if they ask to do so. And these contracts were upheld by my good friend Mallon Pitney in a case called Hitchman Coal against Mitchell, having to do with coal strikes. And the theory of the American left is that if you're telling people that they're not allowed to unionize, it's the most evil form of coercion imaginable. And they said the wages will be reduced to dirt. Now, first of all, they won't be reduced to dirt. If you go back and you actually look at the facts in the Hitchman Coal case, what the management was worried about was the loss of flexibility, having a union there, and was worried about workers going out en masse at a point which could make it impossible for them to get the coal out of the mine, wasting labors, but they offered them competitive wages. They said, we will give you the same wages that you had before, the same wages that they have in union plan. So you're not trying to win money by exploitation. You get perfectly rational gains. So then the question is, well, why will the workers sign up for this thing? Well, ask the question in the following way. Why is it the guys in Nashville never seem to sign up with the United World of Workers? Because the moment you decide to lock your hands into a union, you're doing the following choice. You're saying, I'm going to take some very risky strategies in the hope of getting higher wages, knowing that I can be out on strike for a very long period of time and knowing that I may lose this particular job if the mine itself is going to have to shut down. And it's perfectly rational for many workers to say we would rather do that. From a social point of view, it's a godsend. Because unions are monopolies, this is something that union people never want to talk about. They always talk about collective action and collective bargaining. They never talk about cartelization. But if you go back to, again, the pre-New Deal cases, unions were held when they engaged in collective refusals to deal to be in violation of the antitrust laws unanimously in 1908. And it was that decision that was overturned by the Clayton Act when Woodrow Wilson became president in 1914. So when I went to the Yale Law School and wrote this long paper on the yellow dog contract in the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the New Deal, I cannot begin to tell you the horror, the yells, the bedlam that came directed at me by people who thought otherwise. But as I thought then, as I thought now, the basic essential purpose of regulation in a sensible state is to control monopolies either by breaking them up or by regulating them when they cannot be broken up and still operate efficiently. The New Deal goes in exactly the opposite direction. It says, whenever we have good competitive markets, we have to cartelize them. So to say that this brings us back to the yellow dog contract is to me saying you really don't understand anything about labor relations prior to 1935, which is an endemic policy problem today. It's true of Ruth Ginsburg. She doesn't know anything about this subject. It's true of Noah Feldman, who said anybody who defends the current situation on arbitration is like a man from the moon. It's true of the New York Times, which says every time you give a take it or leave it offer, you're engaged in massive coercion. The great tragedy of the progressives, in my view, is that they have not learned a single thing about how labor markets work in the 80 years since the National Labor Relations Act has been put into place. And this is a very damning indictment. Now, in the opinion, Justice Gorsuch is not a revolutionary. He would never say the kinds of things that I would say. He's an institutionalist. He has Justice Roberts on his side, who is deeply opposed to the jurisdiction that I'm defending in the earlier period. So he gives a much more restrained and perfectly justifiable sentence. He says, look, there was no yellow door contract when these clauses were routinely enforced. All we're doing is we're preserving a status quo, which everybody had existed under this act for close to 75 years. Why are you raising this red herring? And it seems to me that that is a perfectly sensible argument to say, even if we take the current institutional framework, it has worked very well in this fashion for a long period of time. Why are you bringing out this ogre and this specter? And you have to understand, many of the conservative judges agree with the liberals on the whole question about unionization and yellow door contracts. I'm the outlier on this particular situation, but I'm an academic. I'm not trying to build a coalition and so forth. I'm trying to tell things as I've seen it. And for the past 35 years, when I first wrote about this problem in 1983, I've been not the only, but certainly the loudest and most consistent defender of the yellow door contract. And I'm not going to run for cover when I see somebody write an opinion which I regard as essentially utterly uninformed about the state of labor affairs. And as I did point out in this article, in many places, is that if you look at see where the greatest period of improvement in human welfare exists in the history of the world, it's during the so-called evil lot in the era between 1870 and 1940, where everything from life expectancy to earned income to technological advance was at its all-time zenith. And to say that somehow or other this happens in spite of a legal system which is so corrupt is very, very odd. I think what one has to say is legal systems don't invent technologies, but they facilitate their invention, and that people have to completely rethink the stuff that's going on there. So what happens is Justice Gorsuch very temperately tries to avoid this ultimate classical liberal progressive debate, and the dissent raises it. And I think he was right in his institutional role to do what he did. But I think it is a terrible mistake for anyone to let the political and economic arguments that were made in the dissent and in the pieces in the literature go unanswered, because they reflect, to be just perfectly blunt about it, an abysmal ignorance about the structure of American labor and antitrust law in the progressive period before 1935, when the National Labor Relations Act was passed.
All right. Thank you, Richard, and thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.